are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Welcome to Serious Growth Podcast, where the truth is told. Some of you may notice that I'm not in a regular studio. I'm here at my office, and what we're doing today is responding to what's going on in today's world with coronavirus. So we're practicing social distancing. On today's show, we have Riley. Riley, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Leo.
Nice. Nice to have you. Hey, listen, I was checking out your certification. I mean, not your certification, but your bio. And I noticed that you're certified as a hitting coach. Mm-hmm. And I would just like for you to tell us and tell the people on the show exactly what that means.
Yes. Yeah, so I am OnBase U certified. And OnBase U is an organization that certifies hitting coaches and pitching coaches. I'm an OnBase U hitting certified coach. And what it basically means is that the OnBase U program or company specializes in the biomechanics of hitting. And after you go through a two-day seminar, you learn a lot of the theory applied to hitting. And after you have done that theory, you can get tested on the theory to become certified. So once you get certified, you now have the information and you can take it back to your hitting facility, your team, and apply it to your hitters.
Okay, that makes sense. And the biomechanics, tell me how and why knowing the biomechanics to hitting, you know, obviously, you know, for those that are in the game, they're going to know that it's to help the athlete become a better hitter. But exactly how does that happen?
Yeah, so in the MLB, there are so many different types of hitters from different sizes, mobilities, all the above. And maximizing your ability is different than being 6'9" or 6'8" right-handed pitcher versus a 5'11" right-handed pitcher. Those two guys are going to look very different throwing a pitch. But what maximizes it biomechanically is your kinetic sequence. And if we're maximizing power from the ground up, I'm going to have much more ability to swing with velocity and rotate with velocity than I would if I started, for example, from the top and my bottom just rotated because the top rotated. So basically you want to have the most efficient sequence possible in order to maximize your angular and linear rotation or velocity to maximize your swing.
Query to the ball. Okay, so then the sequencing, tell me, break that down if you could.
Right.
For me, like a layman, if you can, more layman terms. So what is it, exactly does that mean? As a certified instructor, is there a certain a way that you do that, for example, like developing an athlete from the ground up as far as sequencing them? How does that work?
Yep. I'll give you a good analogy, actually. So okay. I'm going to ask you a question. So if I had six people total, three people in two groups, okay? I had a 6'4" linebacker. I had a 6-foot point guard. And I had a 5'4" gymnast. Okay, so I got a big dude, medium-sized guy, small gymnast. Mm-hmm. And I had 3 6-foot point guards on this other group, okay? So now they're all the same size, mm-hmm. relatively. And I wanted to have them put each other on their shoulders, and the top person is going to have a big ring, and I want to see which group can throw the ring the highest.
Mm-hmm.
Which group would you want to instruct?
To make that ring go the highest.
To throw it the highest. They can't leave each other's shoulders. We're going to stack them up. And I want to see which of the three or which of the two groups can throw the ring the highest. Would you want same size?
Or the other group?
Yes.
Okay, here's my question I want to ask you. The people that are on the bottom,
mm-hmm.
do they have to just be still or can they bend their legs?
Nope, they can bend their legs.
Okay, I would want the smaller group.
Why?
Because I think the smaller group, now this is me, from my background, I'm thinking that the smaller group of people compared to the ones that are the same size are going to be more explosive.
Okay. But who could generate the most force?
Well, based on my answer, I got a feeling it's the people that are all the same size.
No, it's the three that are diverse.
Oh, so I was actually right, but for the wrong reason.
Because if I have my big guy on the – so what you can do is you get to pick how they're going to stack up. Obviously, that you would pick the big dude on the bottom, right?
Yeah.
And you'd have him get his legs going and explode up.
Right.
And then the wave effect. So same thing with your kinematic sequence.
Okay.
You generate the most force from the bottom half of your body.
Right. I agree.
And then it goes to the torso.
Right.
And then in the swing, it goes front elbow and then your barrel.
Right.
So your kinematic sequence max efficiency is hips. You put a sensor on your hips, chest, front elbow, barrel.
Okay. So with that being said, then that's how you have to train that athlete. It's in that order all the time. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, okay. But you can't. The catch is that you can't do that by video analysis.
You have to do it actually.
Kinematic sequencing with sensors.
Right. Now, does that have anything to do with? Because athletes, hitters, I should say, they all have a timing device that they have when they're in the box. Does that have anything to do with what you're talking about? Does that factor in at all?
I mean, the changeup would definitely mess up their sequence because their front half or their lower half is probably going to go a little quicker. So yes, it would show some differences, but generally, if you have a hitter who usually has a pretty good sequence, you're not going to see a drastic change based on timing. They're probably going to be able to time in pretty well, but you also can have really good hitters that have pretty weird sequences, and you can have really bad hitters that have great sequences. But whenever you're training to maximize efficiency, most of the time your elite hitters are going to have pretty efficient sequences. But
okay, so here's something. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish that thought.
Well, I was just going to say a big thing that can affect a sequence is how you are biomechanically engineered, and that's where strength and conditioning comes into all of this.
Okay, because I was going to say, you know, one of the things. My oldest son came through and ended up playing for the Royals, okay? So I had really as an honor, actually, as it turns out, when he was going through that process, I was able to sit with a scout that was actually recruiting him. They let me sit in the dugout with him. And he you know, it's really fascinating to talk with somebody who had been around the league that long, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. You know, experience plays a big role, you know, years and years of it. And one of the things that he talked about at that point, he said, you know, one of the mistakes that college coaches are making is they're trying to make every hitter hit the same as far as their technique. Like if you go to these different colleges, he was talking about, or high schools. And he said, and what that does, he thought, in his opinion, was take the genius out of that natural ability, the natural athletic ability that athlete has. And now I think that you may have answered the question. That's where you said that's where sports-specific training like strength and conditioning comes in. Did I read that right from you?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
It's like if you were going to – if you expected Derek Jeter to be a Barry Bonds, his swing is way different than it did his whole career. But if you look at Derek Jeter and Barry Bonds, they're both great hitters.
Yeah. But
they both maximized what their body was able to do.
So then, and as a certified hitting coach, would you just build upon that?
Yes.
And make him even better?
Yes. Like, I'm not going to try to make a 5'4", small left-handed power slapper turn into, you know, an All-American home run hitter. That's not who she is. That's not who he or she is, you know? It's all based on the individual. But what the certification really goes into is if they have an inefficient sequence.
Yeah.
Is it just because they don't understand how the body moves, or is it because there's a deficiency in one of their stable or mobile joints that needs to be corrected?
Yeah. And if you can do that and make those kinds of adjustments, as opposed to making it just, okay, everybody's got to do the same thing. you know, that really does make an athlete. That changes the ball game right there as far as, you know, it's a game of inches. You've heard that before, but, you know, it's the small things that you do that creates that competitive edge. And that's what I'm hearing from you, is really being able to analyze, you know, that hitter and not disrupt his natural God-given ability.
Right. So similar to the weight room, it's like if you get a new client and you don't know what they can and can't physically do, how can you really start? Or how can right. you expect them to do something that they can't physically do if you've never assessed their ability to do it? So yeah. as with this program, with this certification, we learned that the first step as a hitting coach is to figure out what your athlete can physically do or what they can't do.
Yeah.
Because they tell you that you need to rotate more on your front side, but you don't have the mobility or the stability or one or the other to do that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to get frustrated.
Yeah.
And you're going to get frustrated.
Yeah.
But you can't do it.
Right.
So it takes the frustration out.
Oh yeah. There's a lot more than meets the eye. You have, you know, I know that because I've been around athletics all my life, and I've been lucky enough to, you know, not only work with Major League Baseball players, but my kid's been one of those players that's come through the ranks, and I've watched that process happen. Because like with him, you know, he was really quick with his hands, and that was his natural God-given ability. He has such quick hands, but what that did is that overshadowed, in other words, he wasn't using that sequence, his lower body, to get him started. He was so good with his hands, he never had to rely on that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then here's where it caught up to him a little bit, because when he got you know, the coaches that I spoke to, what I learned back then was that in baseball, and it's in every sport, each position has a breakdown of what's most important as far as what that athlete needs to do. Mm-hmm. Most important to the least important. Now, when my son, when he got up to the big leagues, he wasn't quite fast enough to be a center fielder. And I know some of the dynamics have changed because athletes are different now. But at that point, a center fielder, because that's where he usually played, they're fast. And their number one thing that they want them to do is to run side to side and run the balls down in the gaps, right? Mm-hmm. But when he got to that level, and high school was fine. But when he got to the college level, where is the Division One? I mean, Cal State Fullerton. I mean, these guys are all great athletes. You know, when you get to that point, like where you did, it's just who, you know, how do you, how are you beating out that next person? Anyway, so he wasn't quite fast enough to play center field, but he didn't have the power to play the corners necessarily. He was kind of a tweener, they called it.
Yeah.
Well, that's when he had to make that adjustment. At that level was to learn how to start using his lower body so he could hit more home runs. And that's exactly what he did. I think that's kind of what you're talking about a little bit, right?
Yeah. So I think very similar to what you're saying, the difference that a lot of hitting coaches are facing now, and it seems like he had a great coach because they addressed it. But what happens today is you have your strength coach and you have your skills coach, your hitting coach. And a lot of times we go to our hitting coach and we go hit for, you know, practice or before practice. And we go hit. We're working on these things. Coach is telling us to make these adjustments. But if our coach is screening us and he knows our deficiencies, when we go to our strength coach or the athletic trainer, the physical therapist or the chiropractor, if they don't know what the deficiencies that this hitting coach sees, if they're not aware, then are we working as a team? No.
No.
We're both doing our job.
Yeah.
We're both making I'm making them stronger and I'm making them a better hitter. But the key is that these two combine. And so the coach, the hitting coach, can then go to the strength coach and say, hey, my player is having a hard time rotating the hips and the torso. It's just one piece right now. Can you help me with the rotation and the separation of the hips and the torso?
Yeah.
Great. That makes the strength coach's job much more rewarding when they know that what they're working on with that one hitter is directly impacting his ability on the field.
So, okay, I'm gonna say the way that I would one of the best ways would be for the skills coach to have to pass a certification of sport-specific training and vice versa. I mean, that would seem like the most logical thing to do. But how are you really addressing that? because I'm sure that's probably really in the real world not happening.
Right. So then here's another analogy for you. It's kind of like a race car driver and the crew. So your race car driver is the athlete, and their job is to drive the car. Their job is to go every day, go practice and everything. And you have your crew chief, who is your hitting coach. Your crew chief is in charge of looking at all the little odometers on the all the gauges and saying, all right, what's going on here? What can we do to make the race car driver drive faster, more efficiently, no issues. So their job is to read that gauge. And then from that point, you take the information from the crew chief, and the pit crew is now the strength coach, the PT, the AT, the chiropractor, and in some cases equipment. But it's the crew chief's job to communicate that to the pit crew.
Right.
And so if that is communicated, then we can work on all cylinders. And because the on-base U organization knows that that's a key part, they're developing, in addition, so any of the PT, chiropractic, anybody can go get certified as well, and they're doing another medical side.
Yeah.
And so now the coach, their main job, the hat that they wear, is to be the hitting coach. And they're not going to step on the strength coach's toes and say, hey, he needs to be doing this. No, it's the strength coach's job. That's his profession. That's the hat that he wears. And so if they can do their job, if they want further certification on the rotational hitting aspect, on-base U provides that for them.
Gotcha. So what happens, I like that, because that makes total sense. So there's a pecking order there. But when it comes down right down to, maybe you have a skills coach that's really strong-headed, or a strength coach that's pig-minded. I mean, I'm just trying to make up some scenarios. Okay, so who makes the, do we just go, because I have a strong personality. I might just go toe-to-toe with you if you're the skills coach, and I say, I don't agree with you. So how does something like that, how do those differences get solved? And again, maybe this is not really something that happens. I'm just trying to think of what might happen. So how does that get solved within your dynamic as a hitting coach with a skills coach and a head coach for baseball? How does that all get resolved?
I would say that if there is such a big disagreement, either a new strength coach comes in if the hitting coach is really that good. And if the hitting coach is that big headed, he better be, if he's getting the results that he needs, he probably doesn't give two shits what the strength coach is doing. He probably only cares about his area. Now,
exactly.
It doesn't stop the strength coach from doing his own mobility screens and stability screens on the athletes. Yeah. So when he's in his world, he can do whatever the hell he wants, and the coach does not care what he's doing.
Right.
So you can be working to his advantage without him even knowing it.
Yeah.
But if the hitting coach is not producing, he's not going to be in it very long.
That's true. And it does really come down. It's about the result. In baseball, there's a saying, what have you done for me lately? You can be going really well as a hitter, but well, you start going 0-for-20 and your ass is going to be out, especially when you're up at that, you have to prove yourself, but you kind of know what I mean. The results, I'm just trying
to hit to play
these different scenarios, and you're right about that, interesting. Okay. So let me, now what I'm really curious about is how this all got started for you. We know where you ended up. You ended up playing at Arizona. You played at Missouri. But I want to know where you started and how you got actually into the sport of, in your case, is softball. So why don't you tell me, first of all, how old were you when you first got into baseball or softball or whatever it was back then?
Yeah, I believe I was 5, like T-ball. I've been playing my whole life. My parents always encouraged sports. I played 3 sports all the way through high school until my junior year, tore my ACL. Yeah. Didn't play senior year of basketball just because I was already committed to college and didn't want to risk another injury. I started playing at a young age. I never really had a favorite sport. I actually played baseball from 10 to 12, and that was a time that the fundamentals really became more concrete for me of the sport of baseball, which at the time were pretty, and still are, similar to softball. And I really, the baseball league locally was considered playing up for me. I wasn't playing with my level. I was playing up. Mm-hmm. And I think that that really helped cement. I had to learn. I had no other choice than to learn, or else I was going to fail.
But something like that either makes you fail or are you accept. Like
you have no option, you know?
Yeah.
You're in it.
Yeah.
And you're either going to look a fool.
Yeah.
Or you're going to figure it out and do better.
Exactly. But let me ask you this. Were there any, so baseball, were you playing in the boys league or did they have softball at that level at that point? Why did you play in the boys league as opposed to softball, I guess is my question.
Yeah. So they did have softball locally and with some travel teams. But I remember as a kid, I would go to my brother's games. I have two brothers. Uh-huh. And kids my same age, like, were so far ahead of where I was. Uh-huh. And I was jealous. You know, I was like, man, like.
That's competitive right there. You were competitive right there.
So I asked my parents, I was like, can I play over here? And they were obviously with three kids, they were going from park to park.
Yeah.
And it was more convenient for me to play anyways.
Yeah, you changed that shit, didn't you?
Yeah. So I started playing and you know what? I loved it. Like it was hard, but
yeah.
That's where you get challenged and that's where you can succeed when things are hard. Like it's the success is so much more rewarding when it was some tough shit to begin with.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, you know?
Yeah.
And so do you think that starting out playing baseball as opposed to softball actually made you better as a softball player? And maybe you're telling us a little bit why, but why was that?
Yeah, well, I did have a great coach. Frank DeRozzo has been a coach in Visalia for years.
Boys coach?
Recreational baseball.
Okay.
But he sticks to the fundamentals and he, in practice and stuff, he doesn't really ever ask you to do things that are outrageous. So like the Sports Center top 10 plays. Sticking to the basic fundamentals of the game. And it provided a really good foundation for me for the sport moving forward. And in middle school is when my parents decided that it was probably a good time for me to switch back to softball because we were getting older and they just thought I could either stay at 60 feet bases or go back to 90 feet bases. And so they wanted me to play softball. And I was going to quit. I didn't want to go try out.
Really?
I was like not having it. I was like, I'll play one of my other sports then. Don't worry about it. And a local coach asked me to come try out for his team because he needed a catcher. And I was a catcher. And I went and there was actually a college softball catcher from Redwood at the tryout, who's now a cop with VPD. And I was during the tryout, I was kind of like, she's pretty tough. Like, maybe there are some tough players in softball, you know, kind of like opened my eyes. And long story short, I played on that team, fell in love with the game, the speed of the game, and I wore her number on that team. And all the way through the rest of my experience in college, I wore 36. And she was a big motivating factor and still is today. She battles a disease. It's called Crohn's disease. It's like in the intestinal tract. And she's a cop and fully functioning. It's pretty awesome.
You know, the thing that's going to be common for you, you're young still. But I can share with you too that, you know, along my, you know, path to when I was becoming an athlete, there were just certain people that just turned out to be mentors. And you don't even know sometimes how big of a mentor that they're going to end up being. You know, it's weird how some people stay in your life for a long time and, you know, and in your athletic career, be it coaches or, you know, ex-mates, teammates. Yeah. But it's just really interesting. I think one of the common things that I've always heard over the years, and I do a lot of this podcasting, is that we have there's certain just people that just become these, you know, for whatever reason, you know, just like your coach. I think one of the smart things, DeRozzo, is that his name? Mm-hmm. I think one of the smart things that, based on what you're communicating to me, was he kept it simple, you know, to the basics. And because a lot of times it's just really all about that, you know. In football, there was a coach called Woody Hayes, and he had something like four plays that he ran. Or maybe it was the guy that for the Green Bay Packers, one of those coaches. Yeah. But, you know, it was like he didn't have many plays, but the plays that they had, they ran them with perfection. You know, every single time it was correct, you know, implementation, it's hard to beat that. So I think your coach at that point did you a huge favor because it sounds like that is something that carried on for you.
Yes, and I've been lucky to have some amazing coaches and amazing teammates. And Coach Kendrea is at Arizona. He's our head coach, and he's been coaching there longer than I've been alive. He was also the Olympic coach for a few of the Olympic teams, actually. But last year at the World Series, as an athlete, I was still playing at the time. We're about to go play in front of 10,000 people on national television after playing all season with a great crowd at home. But World Series, heightened emotions.
It bumps up a little bit more.
Yeah, a little more adrenaline going.
Yeah,
And I'll never forget in our pregame meeting, he said, it's still 60 feet to first and 43 feet from the mound. And you don't need to
keep
be any
simple,
better.
Baby.
You don't need to be any better than you were yesterday, but you can't be any worse.
That's smart. That's a coachable experience.
That's
he
right.
Nails it right there, right to the point.
40 years.
No, I like that. You got to bring it back to that. You know, in training, I can tell you this, as a bodybuilder, when I first started into the sport, you know, you try all these exercises, and then at the end of the day, after 15 years, you know, as you're learning, it comes down to like a core group of exercises that you use that are the ones that are your go-to. They always work. But the point that I'm trying to make is that we're bringing it back to keeping it simple and basic, you know, and you work on your technique and your form, and you become that athlete who is not just playing part of the time, but you're playing 100% of the time, you know, because like the great ones, that's right. The great ones make their opponents play from start to finish.
Yep.
Let them have, that's right. You know, because yes, you know, when you get into the games that are where you're competing against teams that are as good as you, a lot of times what ends up breaking down is the discipline and the mindset because they just don't have it at that point. But it's not something that's easily learned. I mean, you got to have in your coaching, you know, just like what you're doing with your hitting coach. You have to be, as far as I'm concerned, you have to be, when you're working with somebody on their sequences, I mean, again, I'm just talking from my own experiences. You have to be somebody who stands for, look, this has to happen all the time. Not when you're feeling good, not when you're, you know, you feel like it, but it's when you're feeling shitty and things are going bad. You can't go back to your old habits. I mean, be wrong.
Yeah, no. I completely agree. I can remember throwing some balls from first to third. So tired, I have chills, and it's like 110 degrees in Arizona. And I'm exhausted. Yeah. But you know what? I knew damn well if it was a throw on a tag and I threw it up at the chest, I was going to get chewed out. And you know what? Yeah. No one should have to chew me out. Yeah. I should know better. But it takes the focus. And I think you could probably definitely agree with this. I've never felt more aware of my environment and my surroundings, not only my surroundings, but my task at hand. I've never felt more aware of my task at hand than in those huge moments. So for you, when it was a big lift or a big, you know,
show,
I've never felt more in tune with my own body and my own self and my mind than in those huge moments. And I think that is when, that's a result of when you're preparing, picking yourself up and taking yourself as close as you can to that level, because you know you're never really going to get there in practice. But you've got to raise the bar, and you got to challenge yourself.
Here's what you're saying. I'm going to tell you in another example. They call that sprezzatura, and that's a fashion term. It's an Italian fashion term. Sprezzatura is just real easy definition, is making something hard look easy and elegant. And the reason that you're able to do that is because of all the training, all the discipline, all the times when you felt like shit, and you still did it. And you made sure that you didn't let your ass off the hook because all of a sudden what that does for you, all those repetition is the mother of skill. And all that repetition that you had when you got into that big game, the game for you slows down. You're in the moment. It slows down. That's where you feel the most probably comfortable. Mm-hmm. But you do that same scenario with somebody who doesn't have all the reps in and all the discipline that you did. They frazzle and they get buried by it because the game is so fast, right? It's chaotic. And at your level that you're talking about, again, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just speaking from my own experiences. The game is slowed down. And that's the great ones. The game is slowed down. And they can, that's why they can perform under that environment.
Right. And essentially, this is what we're talking about is why I wanted to become a coach. I've had some great leaders, some great teammates who helped me slow the game down and achieve high performance. And the leaders that I've had make me want to pass that on.
That's awesome.
That, it translates to life. And
yep.
It's pretty hard to fall short when you're doing.
Well, let me tell you something. You being at that age and saying what you're saying, you're way ahead of the game. Let me tell you something. I didn't learn that kind of stuff till later. You know, another question I have for you. So I understand when you're transitioning from learning baseball, because some of the mechanics obviously are going to be different, especially if you're a pitcher. Mm-hmm. And of course the bases are shorter, but I don't know if that's really, but is it, I guess the question is that a hard transition going from, you know, learning baseball and then going into softball?
Right. My age was a factor in that. I feel like I was pretty young. I was too young to really have that awareness of like, oh, okay. Things are changing. But one of my favorite quotes is that the game is simple. People make it complicated.
Yeah.
You know, we're the ones who complicate everything. The game's simple.
Yeah.
It's been the same.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the transition, like I said, I was young, so the pitchers hadn't really developed yet. So seeing the ball coming from the hip instead of over the head wasn't super significant because there wasn't a lot of movement on the pitches. But overall, what I enjoy about softball relative to baseball is the speed of the game. I mean
– Yeah, I was going to say, like, when you're – yeah. So how, for example, that was another thing I was going to ask you. Obviously, when you are the pitchers are up that close, that ball's flying. I mean, how fast is that ball really going at that distance?
Yeah. So because the mound is 43 feet, relative to baseball, a 70 mile an hour pitch is equal to a 100 mile pitch.
Holy shit!
So I mean, the reaction time is pretty nuts. And when you're playing in Division I, the pitchers who throw 60 to 65, they're almost just as filthy because if they're throwing that fast and they're successful, it means they have some nasty movement.
Yeah, I mean, so as a hitter, let me ask you this. I know, like, you know, again, people have their own style of hitting. Some people pick their leg up higher and they have different strides, you know. Again, but when you're that close, I mean, as far as, like, your stance – is there much time to really have, like, pick your foot up? Is it just picking your foot up and putting it right back down the same place? Or can you actually stride?
No, there are some leg kicks. There are all the things that you see in baseball. I think the only difference with speed of a pitcher is when it starts. The pace of your stride and your motion doesn't change a whole lot. But I think if you were to compare baseball to softball in the distance, you would just see a softball player start earlier than a baseball player. But I mean, there are a lot of parallels between the elite softball hitters and the elite baseball hitters. The main difference between the two is that in baseball, everything's coming out of down plane.
Yeah.
And in softball, because it comes from the hip, it comes at you.
Different trajectory.
There, or down. Or soft, you know.
Yeah.
So it's...
Yeah.
It changes it up, but having to hit the up is what really changes the sport compared to baseball.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the hardest things to do is hit a baseball that's moving, a round bat with a round ball and being able to hit it squarely. I mean, that's, that's the reason why I think, you know, you're successful in baseball and you have less than a 500 average. You're still at 300. That you're a success, basically, you know, at the higher levels, you know. That's really amazing. One of the things I wanted to ask you is you said you started as a catcher. And when did you transition to first base?
2 weeks before my first college game.
Oh, really?
I played some corner infield through high school. And I considered myself a utility, but my main spot was catcher. And I actually played third base when I first got to college. And the third baseman, or the first baseman, the girl that went to first base while I was playing third, had played third the previous season. And she's actually now the third baseman on the Mexican national team. Great athlete. Played at Missouri and LSU, All-American. And coach had us swapped. And 2 weeks before the season started, he swapped us back. And I played first base 98% of my career. And the only time I switched was to fill in and give our catcher a break. I think I played third a little bit my sophomore year because our third baseman got injured. But I played first base all the way through and I absolutely loved it.
So why is it that your coach swapped you? Do you have a reason for doing that?
So I initially had the position because I had better range at third base. And okay. She really wanted to play third. And, you know, I was a freshman at the time. I just wanted to play. I didn't give a shit where you put me. I just wanted to be in the game. And if I was in the game, I was happy. But anyways, he told both of us. He said, you have more range, so you've won the position. And she went home over Christmas break and dropped 20 pounds.
And wow.
Came back in January.
Play third base.
She got some range. And she's an amazing third baseman, so I was happy to take first. And I actually kind of enjoyed first because coming from being a catcher primarily,
yeah.
I was dependent. The pitcher relies on the catcher, knowing the sport. The catcher is kind of the psychologist of the pitcher. You know, a catcher is not going to treat any two pitchers the same. And right. So I liked having that responsibility as a catcher. And what I liked about first base was getting the confidence of each of my infielders.
Interesting.
And they knew – where if the play is really close, where they should throw it so that I can get my maximum stretch, and like just kind of
right.
You know, all those tiny details that go into elite playing, like I had it, and I really have a big passion for it, and so they trusted me quite a bit as a first baseman.
This is the stuff that, you know, people sometimes say, well, baseball, it's a slow game, but they don't know all the stuff that's going on, like just things mm-hmm. that you're talking about right now. It's just the nuances of the game that make it really interesting as far as I'm concerned, you know. Why did you pick catcher to start with? Why didn't – in the beginning did you – like when you first started, why weren't you an outfielder? What made you want to be a catcher?
My older brother was one.
Following your brother's footsteps, huh?
Yep. Yeah. I wanted to be like him. And it ended up working out because he was a catcher all the way through high school. But back when we were 12 – or he was 12 and I was 11 – we were playing this like championship of league, you know, game, and we had kind of gone through all of our pitchers, and he had done some pitching in the past, but he had to go pitch, and I caught him in the championship game.
Wow! You know, so I'm here. I'm thinking, did it ever come to a like with your coaches? Now let's go up to back to where you switched at the college level. Mm-hmm. Was there, because we're talking about mechanics and hitting. Were the mechanics of throwing ever talked about as far as how it relates to position? Because I know in men's baseball that the mechanics of a third baseman is different throwing-wise, is different than a shortstop, for example, exactly, and a second different. Baseman. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so was that ever discussed?
Oh, yeah.
Were the mechanics much different at first base than it was at third base? I mean, it seemed like to me, like when you're playing different positions like that, because I never did. All I can tell you is this. My little moment of playing, you know, different position was in football. It was an all-star game, high school. I was always a quarterback. But it's an all-star game, and, you know, the coaches let other people play. I went and played linebacker. Holy shit. It was like a whole different ball game, you know? So is it that way when you're going from third to first, or by being dramatic? Because I have a tendency of being dramatic.
From the detail of throwing mechanics, not so much.
No.
But from seeing – from the two corners. But from seeing the ball off the bat, huge difference. Because now I've got – instead of someone being early on a pitch, typically a righty, most batters are righties. Granted, they're
right.
all lefties. But
– yeah.
Much that means that they're early and they're pulling, and when it comes to first base, now they're late,
right?
And it's gonna usually spin all kind of usually weird. So that's a huge difference. But throwing mechanics, I mean, those range from infielders, outfielders, middles, corners, and catchers. So there are a ton of little mechanics, but those types of things are the parts of the game that you learn as you advance in your knowledge, and I was lucky to have some coaches that were I'm lucky to have that they were picky. At the time it was like, you know, I was a freshman, like, seriously, this isn't a big deal, but now like I care about all those
but you have to understand something. You actually have something to do with it as far as I'm concerned, because you're coachable. I can tell that you're someone who's coachable, and that doesn't mean that you don't have an athlete that is strong-minded and they have an opinion. But if you're coachable, you give yourself a lot better shot at this thing, you know. Yeah, and you were. You were, because in order for you to keep adapting as you're going up the scale, you have to change your game, because it doesn't stay the same. You're not going to have the same, you know, you're not going to play the same because you're different. Your body's different when you're 8 years old versus when you're at the college level. Hell, it all changes, I think, to a degree.
Yeah.
And it's always about the athlete being lucky to have coaches, but they're lucky to have somebody who's coachable, as far as I'm concerned. So you have to take some of the credit for that, because you were able to, no, it's true. You were able to accept the advice that they were giving you and apply it on the field. And that doesn't happen with every athlete. That's why some of them drop out.
Yeah, but if you look at the great – there are times in life that I feel, as an athlete and as a human, that you need to step back and look at what all the greatest athletes – for me, it was look at what all the greatest athletes do.
Yeah.
Do they take criticism? And a common, you know, a fable we tell ourselves is that you either have a lot of talent or you have to give a lot of effort.
Yeah.
So what about those athletes that have a lot of talent and give a lot of effort?
Right.
Those are the ones that we talk about.
Exactly. Because I'm going to tell you something. One of the things I saw a lot happen throughout my career is that the guys that had, or I'm going to speak for just for the guys' team. Mm-hmm. A lot of times the guys that had all the talent did not make it because they didn't have the desire and the perfect willingness to do that. They just relied on pure natural athletic ability, and you got to have that. But you got to have that person that has the desire and the will to do the work. That's just how I see that.
And those are the ones we're talking about.
Yeah, that's what you're talking about. Yeah.
So I think as an athlete, recognize that.
Yeah, exactly. As far as, again, with that coach, Scott, that I sat in the dugout that one day, mm-hmm. he talked about the at every position, there were responsibilities and priorities that were the most important to the least. Did they ever address that at your level in college or anywhere that you played?
Yes, but I would say that I don't think it was really by position. I think it was because in softball, another variable that you have is a slapper. And a slapper's job is to just get on base. They're the speedsters that put the ball on the ground in the infield and just get to first base because it's so close.
Yeah.
So slappers don't have a main position. Typically, they're outfielders because they're fast. But you could have our second baseman is an occasional slapper. But you can have a slapper that plays anywhere over the field. So I think in softball, as long as you have a balanced lineup, I mean, some coaches don't really – so some coaches go for power, and some coaches like to have the speedsters in there. So I don't think it's really position specific as much as it is let's have a complete lineup. And if we have that, then we're good to go.
Yeah. Now I see here that you hit 24 home runs. Now you hit 306. This is at Missouri, and 24 home runs. I have no idea if that's a lot of home runs, because I'm going to assume that it is. And like, what's the, did you lead the league in 24 home runs, or where were you in relation to that?
No, I would say I was a pretty average home run hitter. Nothing significant. I had a teammate last year. She leads the NCAA, and before this virus came about, she was 19 away from being the career home run leader. And last year alone, she hit 29.
Really?
In one
season. Position did she play?
Shortstop. And I have a couple other teammates that weren't far off. So 8 on most teams would be great. Arizona, we have girls that hit. We had 3 girls that were in the 20s in one season.
No kidding.
Yeah, pretty much. Nice.
Now, when my son was coming up, the scouts said they usually put the power hitters on the corners, third base, first base, left field, right field. Those are the power hitters. So their foot speed wasn't the top priority. Hitting for power, hitting bombs was your job on the corners. Now, the game has changed now, because back then, your shortstops and second basemen didn't hit for much power, and they're hitting for more power now because the game has changed a little bit that way, you know. So I don't know, you know, is it like that on your team?
Not at all, actually. Kind of funny. So our two main home run hitters, there's a lot of home run hitters on our team. We were second in the NCAA in home runs last year. So in all of NCAA. Yeah.
Now this is Arizona, right? That you're talking about?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Our center fielder, our shortstop, shortstop, our third baseman, and our catcher. And our catcher actually is currently on the U.S. Olympic team. That's the only reason I haven't included her in a lot of these, but she made the U.S. Olympic team. She's one of two college athletes to be on the U.S. Olympic team out of 15. Wow. Yep.
That's awesome. What an experience that you've had. I mean, you've been so lucky. This is going to mean even more to you, you know, as you get down the road. But now, with regard to you moving forward, now you want to be a hitting coach. So tell me what your – okay, if Riley can have – if you could, you know, if you could do whatever you wanted right now with regards to that, what does that look like for you? What would you like to be now from this point forward?
Well, in the field of hitting, I feel like I still have so much more to learn. But I do know that that's what I want to do. And so for me at this moment in time to be around these on-base youth certified coaches, if I could just expose myself to them and the technology that they're using, I think that that would help me learn a lot. I go into it with a complete growth mindset because I feel like I've just, you know, got my feet wet with some of the material that we've covered. And so for me, it would be as a graduate assistant, which is where my next phase is, to propel myself by learning the most I can, out of the on-base U. And really it's this biomechanics stuff and the mobility and stability stuff. So that's where I'm headed, actually.
I'll tell you what, here's my take on you. Okay. Cause I'm always sizing up people just in general, especially athletes. And you know, one of the things you have, I have a creed. I call it Serious Growth Creed. It relates to bodybuilding. And one of the components that's in that creed, which you have, is you're a student of the game. And I can tell that you have, into the nth degree, type of mentality. You have warrior mindset. And I think you're that athlete that questions everything, but not in a way where you're like trying to pick a fight, you know?
Yep.
And I think that what the sense that I get from you is that you're willing to learn this thing from the ground up, because if you do that, if you really do the Albert Einstein, one of his favorite quotes was, he said, real knowledge is through experience. My dad told me something in a different way, which meant the same thing as Albert Einstein said. He said, it's very hard to replace firsthand experience. And I see you as that person that's coming through. You started at the age of 5 years old. You've gone and you've done every little thing. You're hungry for information. You're enthusiastic. I mean, I don't think there's anything stopping you but you. If you just said, hey, you know, I'm going to do something else, I think that's the only reason that you're not going to get what you want. And I think it's pretty common, but just, you know, I feel your drive and I appreciate that because it inspires me. You know, I'm an old dude now. I'm going to be 65 and I'm lucky because I'm still doing something that I'm still following my dream, Riley, and it has really little to do with being an athlete. But it's now taking that information, what you're going to do, and you're going to keep passing that forward to your athletes. Do you ever have aspirations of being the head dog, the head coach, or do you want to be more of the hitting coach or the biomechanics hitting coach, or do you want to be the big one?
Yeah, I do one day, but first off, thank you. That means a lot to me. This whole process has been awesome, and I think that the transition has been smoother because I'm still in the game from playing to now on the other side. But I think passion can alleviate some of the more sad components of not playing anymore. But
right,
that I'm passionate about definitely has helped. Well, but yeah, I do eventually, I think that's in the cards. But like I said, I respect experience, and I've been lucky to be coached by experienced coaches, but the only way to get experience is to start rolling your sleeves up and getting to work. And so I am so grateful that I've been put in positions that are going, I have been in the past and I will be here upcoming shortly being put in positions that allow me to get that experience. Nice. And in ways, what's cool about, so this next fall, I'll be starting at Fresno State. I'll be a graduate assistant at Fresno State. And what's really cool is I don't really, my intention is not to coach the athletes at Fresno State. I'm a graduate assistant. I'm here to learn. And being from the Valley, I'm hoping that I'll be able to apply what I'm learning to the youth and go to the batting cage, my lab, and apply this. And so I can learn it while I'm learning from the best of the best.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. Here's my, exit on this thing for you is I'm going to give you some advice. Now I probably can't give you any other advice that your dad's going to give you, but I can tell you one thing from personal experience. If you have passion for what you do and you love what you do more than anything else, you follow that passion and that dream, because it will, I'm telling you, I did that when I made that decision to become a personal trainer in 1982 when no one was doing it. It didn't matter to me. I wanted that passion in the belly. And I'll tell you what, amazingly, I've never worked a day in my life since then, even though I've worked it, you know, every day because I love it that much. And that would be my advice to you. Follow that passion, man. That is huge. And that makes a big difference. As we're now ending the show, is there anything that you would like to promote on the show or say as far as something maybe to an athlete out there that's watching this and looking up to you? Because there are those out there. Is there anything you'd like to say before we leave?
Yeah, I mean, I would say to any athletes that are watching this to keep your mind open. If you think that you know all there is to know about what you're doing, you need to ask more questions and you need to stop talking and start listening some more. Cause I think, for myself personally, it was, if I would have closed my ears to any of the incoming information, even after my first year of college, I would have missed out on so much information. And I felt like I was a pretty mature player even then. And I think that the amount of growth that I even had in my last 2 weeks of playing was huge for me. So always keep your mind and your ears open to anything, but also use your filter and your foundation of knowledge as your advantage.
I think that's really smart advice, and people better pay attention to that because that's good stuff right there. Listen, I really appreciate you coming on the show today. One of the things I love about doing this stuff is I always learn from people. You taught me some stuff about the hitting sequences and the things that you're doing. I think it's really, really awesome, and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Leo. I'll see you tomorrow.
All right. Okay, sounds good. Thanks for coming in. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.